When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. Just a little bit in Glinkonomics this week. Mortgage interest rates fell again. We are seeing continued pressure because everybody's really nervous about what's going on around the world. They are pouring their money into the U.S. Now, our stock market slipped a bit, and yet bonds are looking really strong. So if you are unfortunately looking for a place to put your money, we're the safest bet, and yet doesn't look so good right now. We'll have to see how the rest of the numbers come in from the second quarter as we move into the third quarter to kind of get a sense of where the read is going. Overall, there's a feeling that we're just not seeing the kind of momentum that we were hoping for, even though the third and final revision of the first quarter numbers is now positive. Remember, it was negative for the first quarter. Now it's up to 0.6%. Functionally, that's like zero. Like, the economy is treading water. And for the second quarter, we were at, I think, 2.3% growth. This is nowhere near where we should be. And yet, we are seeing more people get hired. We are seeing the economy continue to move, grow very slowly. New home numbers fell off the shelf again this week after growing strongly. I'm still a little mixed about where we're going. Maybe in the next couple of weeks, we'll get a little bit more insight when everybody comes back from summer break. This week, I'm excited to welcome Peter Bell to the show. Peter's the president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association, and we're going to talk about some recent changes to regulations governing the reverse mortgage industry that came from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Lenders making these types of loans, which are also known as home equity conversion mortgages, HECMs, crazy name, have new responsibilities to consumers who must be 62 years of age or older to qualify for a reverse mortgage. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, has found that many of the consumers targeted by lenders for these instruments have little or no basic understanding of what they're getting themselves into. So the new regulations are aimed at making this a more transparent market. Peter's got a lot of insight into how that's going to work. And for those of you who see Fonzie out on the screens in the middle of the day advertising these mortgages, beware. There is a lot of stuff to know before you sign on the dotted line. After the interview, I've got a rundown of some potential benefits and one big downside to using a property management company if you're a landlord. Now, I think this is a question on a lot of new real estate investors' minds because they want the income but not the headaches that come with owning a rental property. So I'm going to lay out the pros and cons for you, and then I'm going to tell you what Sam and I do. Then I'm going to end the show with a list of my suggestions for anyone looking to increase the value of their home without making any large capital investments. Now, this segment's really aimed at home sellers who want to get as high a price as they can when they sell their homes, which is true for pretty much all of us, right? And I've got some great tricks home sellers should consider employing before listing a home for sale. So please stay tuned for those as well. Okay, that's the lineup. Let's get started. A reverse mortgage is a form of a home loan, but it's a home loan that's available only to seniors age 62 and older who also have a fair amount of equity in their homes. A reverse mortgage is also known as a home equity conversion mortgage. That's pronounced HECM, which is kind of crazy. According to a survey conducted by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau just this year, consumers had a variety of misconceptions about reverse mortgages. Some believe that reverse mortgages are a government benefit for seniors. Okay, they are not. And many folks just don't grasp that these are loans that actually need to be repaid, and there could be serious consequences if you or your heirs don't. Now, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has issued some new guidelines for reverse mortgage lenders that are aimed at better protecting consumers who are struggling to understand the risks and benefits of taking out a reverse mortgage. I'm happy to welcome Peter Bell to the show today to explain some of these changes. Peter is the president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association. Peter, welcome to the show all the way from Telluride.
Thank you, Elise. It's my pleasure to join you this morning.
It's nice to have you. So I've given this kind of broad description about what a reverse mortgage is, but let's go into a little bit more detail about what is a reverse mortgage and what are some of the requirements on seniors.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, first of all, to keep it a little bit simpler, because I think people tend to make reverse mortgages overly complex in explaining them, a reverse mortgage is a form of a home equity loan that's designed for older homeowners, those over 62 years of age, that allows them to draw on the equity that they've accumulated in their home over the years without having to make current monthly payments. So it's a home equity loan with a deferred repayment feature.
Right.
In other words,
right,
you could draw down the money while you're living in the home, and you don't have to make any payments until you permanently leave the home.
Right.
So you don't have to sell it and move out.
And you're not selling the home, you're not giving up title, and you're not taking on a new monthly payment. Nothing gets repaid until the home is sold or until you permanently move out, right?
Right. Well, that's your option to not repay till then. Some people do take the reverse mortgage as a revolving line of credit, and they do draw down on it. And they do pay it back from time to time, because if you pay it back, it's there for you to draw down again. And one of the beautiful features of the FHA HECM program is that there is an annual adjustment upwards in the available line of credit. So if you pay it back, when they adjust that credit line upwards, you get even more money available to you.
Right, which is supposedly predicated on the idea that the home is increasing in value. That was a problem back in 2008 when home values fell through the floor.
Right, but let me correct you on that. The appreciation is part of the consideration, but the major part is because you're a year older, it gets adjusted upwards. Just like an older person gets a larger percentage of value than a younger person, a 63-year-old would get slightly more money available to them than a 62-year-old. So the upward adjustment in the line of credit is to keep it commensurate with your age and life expectancy.
And what percentage increase is that each year?
It grows by an amount that's roughly equivalent to the interest rate that would have been accruing if you actually drew the money down.
So 3 to 6%?
If you have today a HECM at, say, 0.5% LIBOR plus 250 basis points, you'd be at about 3%. And then the FHA mortgage insurance premium of 1.25%, so you'd be at a 4.25% all in, your line of credit would grow at that 4.25%.
Got it.
Unused balance.
Now, when people take the money from a reverse mortgage, they can do it either as a lump sum, fixed monthly payments, depending if you annuitize it correctly, or as a line of credit, or in combination. Which of those is the most common?
Well, nowadays, the most common is to take a line of credit. Largely because of this growth feature, but it really depends on the individual's needs and motivations. People who are taking out a reverse mortgage in order to pay off a sizable existing mortgage may take out the lump sum in order to use the full amount to pay off their existing indebtedness. So it really is very different depending on the intended use, and there's hundreds of different uses that people pursue with reverse mortgages.
Of course there are. So one of the things that I think people don't realize necessarily is that you may pay off your mortgage using the rest of the equity, but then you also have to continue making your homeowner association payments or your property tax payments. You still need to maintain the property. So it's not as though these properties become, you live in them cost-free.
Well, that's correct. But basically you retain all of the usual responsibilities of property ownership. You know, it's interesting to me because I've heard news reports where they say people are losing their home because they can't pay their taxes and they had a reverse mortgage. And to me, that's crazy, because if you have no mortgage whatsoever, if you own your home free and clear and you don't pay your taxes, you're going to face the same problem. So that's just a function of the responsibilities of property ownership, that you must pay taxes and you must keep the property insured because there is a lender involved here. and you must pay your home ownership dues, but you have to do those things regardless of whether you have a reverse mortgage, a forward mortgage, or no mortgage.
Correct. But do you think that maybe some people just don't understand when they get a reverse mortgage, when the explanation goes in, they're not real sophisticated, they don't understand that those other costs continue?
You know, I hear people make that assertion that that's one of the problems with reverse mortgages. I find that somewhat difficult to believe because we have a very unique consumer protection in that every single prospective borrower, before they can actually complete an application and incur any expenses towards getting a reverse mortgage, must go out and participate in a counseling session, either face-to-face or over the telephone, with a HUD-approved, exam-qualified reverse mortgage counselor. And all of these topics are discussed in detail within that counseling session.
Right. So one of the things that's sort of interesting to me about what's been going on with reverse mortgages is the new spouse rule. So before, if you had an underage spouse and the person who you had to be 62 years of age or older, and so you got the reverse mortgage, and then if you died, your spouse was underage, there were some issues with the spouse being able to continue on in the house. And I believe now that they have straightened out that rule. So is that correct? And would you maybe explain a little bit more about what happens?
Yes. There are two classes of loans with non-borrowing spouses. There are the current loans, the new loans that were made after August 4th last year. So I guess just about a year ago today. New rules kicked in that basically say where there is a spouse living in the property at the time the loan is originated, that the size of the loan will be predicated on the age of the youngest member of the couple. So even though there may be a spouse who's under 62 who is removed from title in order to qualify for the reverse mortgage, that spouse's age will be considered in determining the amount of funds available. And that's done so that HUD can extend the opportunity to remain in the home after the borrower leaves it to that non-borrowing spouse. What happened earlier was that the loan was based on the age of the youngest borrower. So in cases where you either had a borrower or a spouse that was under 62 or a disparity between the two members of the couple's ages, they would sometimes remove the younger person from title in order to qualify based on the larger age and get the larger amount of money. Once the courts ruled that they interpreted the statute to require that the non-borrowing spouse can stay, HUD found itself in a situation where loans were made based on an older age and a larger amount of money, but then the benefits had to be extended to this younger spouse whose age was never considered. So the new rules take care of that. Now, as far as loans made prior to last August 4th, HUD has recently given the lenders the option to assign the loans to HUD and allow the non-borrowing spouse to continue in the home. The non-borrowing spouse in that case cannot draw down any further money, but they can live in the house as long as they meet the obligations, pay the taxes, insurance, maintain the property. They can remain in the house as long as they like.
So one of the questions that came up in the housing crisis was when homes drop so much in value, and in some places they still have not come back to, you know, where they're even. In fact, we have, I think, more than 10 million homes in this country that are still underwater. So I know that there aren't that many reverse mortgages compared to that sample, right? We don't have 10 million reverse mortgages out there. I think sometime you and I had been talking a while back, you were doing between 100,000 and 150,000 reverse mortgages a year. So is that still about how many? And what happens when somebody dies and the house is underwater and there isn't enough money to pay back the loan?
Okay, a lot of questions there.
Sorry, so we can break it down
okay,
a little
no,
bit.
No problem. Let's start with volume. At our highest point, we did roughly 120,000 loans nationwide, and that was back in 2007 before the economic meltdown.
Right.
Nowadays, the industry is doing roughly 60,000 loans nationwide, and we do expect to see growth in the months ahead now that the economy is stabilizing and home values have come back in so many communities around the country. Now, in terms of what happens if there is a reverse mortgage and the value of the home drops, it really doesn't matter. It's a non-recourse loan. So the borrower or the borrower's estate will never owe more than the current value of the home. In fact, HUD allows a payoff at 95% of the then current value at the time that the loan becomes due and payable. The reason it's 95% of the current value is because HUD recognizes that there might be some expenses to be incurred by the seller or the estate in selling the home. So they allow a payoff at 95% of current value. The FHA insurance is enforced there to make the lender whole on whatever the shortfall was from the balance due versus the amount that actually comes from the sale of the home or the payoff of the loan.
So how many homes that had reverse mortgages were sold but were sold for less than the amount that had been borrowed?
You know, I don't know that statistic.
Okay. Last thing, one of the concerns that the CFPB has had and others have had over the years is that reverse mortgages tend to be expensive. Can you address the cost of reverse mortgages and what's happening there with fees?
Well, the fact, the line that reverse mortgages are expensive, I think is a misplaced notion that somebody said many years ago and has been repeated by reporter after reporter, but I don't think the facts bear that out. In fact, the cost of getting an FHA-insured reverse mortgage is really no different than getting an FHA-insured forward mortgage. It's just slightly different in its structure, but the same amount of money for the same duration of time with a forward or a reverse would basically cost pretty much the same amount. So that's a common misperception that's out there. You know, one of the things people say is, well, a reverse mortgage is expensive because the interest is compounding. Well, any mortgage has interest compounding. If you take out a $500,000 mortgage on a forward mortgage on a home and pay it out over 30 years, you pay back a lot more than that $500,000 with that compound interest. You know, you're probably paying double that. So I think it's really a common misperception there. You've hit on two of the common misperceptions here in our discussion. One was that you're giving up ownership of the home when a reverse mortgage is in fact like any other mortgage. There's a lien on the property to secure the lender's position, but you still own the home. This notion that people say they're expensive when really the costs are pretty much the same as other mortgages.
So what are the costs of getting a reverse mortgage then?
Well, there might be an origination fee, but as in all mortgages, there's a trade-off between the interest rate that will accrue and the fees that are charged. So it's possible to get some reverse mortgages with slightly higher interest rate margins, but the fees are paid by the lender. But if not, there could be an origination fee that is that is governed by a formula from HUD, which is 2% of the first $200,000 of value and 1% of the balance thereafter to a maximum of $6,000, no matter what size the loan is. There is the upfront mortgage insurance premium paid to FHA, and that's either 0.5% or 2.5%, depending on how much of the available proceeds the borrower draws out upfront. If you take out less than 60% of the available proceeds in the first year, you only pay 0.5% upfront mortgage insurance premium. That's 0.5% of the value of the property at the time of origination. And if you take out more than the 60%, you pay a 2.5%.
That is a huge difference, 0.5% to 2.5% for simply
going. Yes, and the concept
that.
There is to encourage people to draw out the money more slowly over a longer duration of time. The loans that draw out a higher amount up front tend to have a greater degree of risk to FHA. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they price those to encourage the behavior. And it's been very successful. These changes have resulted in a switch from more people taking out lump sums of all the money up front at fixed interest rates to people instead choosing a line of credit with a variable interest rate in order to be able to take out under the 60% up front and then come back as they need more money after the first year.
And then what's the interest rate that we're looking at on these loans?
Well, the interest rate is comprised of two components. There's an index and a margin. The index is typically the 30-day LIBOR, which these days is, I've been on vacation out here in Colorado a little bit, so I haven't looked at interest rates in a few weeks.
LIBOR's down a little bit right now. This 30-day moves around a lot. It's an interesting point. It's not a very stable interest rate. It has been over the last few years simply because all interest rates around the world are so low, but it's not particularly stable, historically speaking.
But for the most part, they've been in around the 0.5% range, I believe, through most of the past couple of years. And then there's a margin on top of that, right, which is the lender's pricing on the loan.
That's
and the
profit.
Margins range anywhere from, say, 225 basis points to 350 basis points. And the trade-off will be, if you have a higher margin, then you'll have more credit towards the closing costs and the origination fee, so you'll have less out-of-pocket expenses up front.
So, in other words, you're financing the up to $6,000 that people will pay to get these loans.
Yes, and as well as the other closing costs, the title and recordation and other fees associated with it.
So I think when people talk about it being not an inexpensive loan, I think it's interesting to break it down and understand that there is some control that you can put on it. Some of the concerns that people have is, of course, that, well, if you take out the loan and you die a year later, it was really expensive. But that's the case with any mortgage, right? You take out a mortgage and you die a year later, that's expensive too.
It's true of any product. If you buy a flat screen television for $1,000 and you die a month later, you paid an awful lot for your viewing in that month.
So nobody should die.
Right.
Peter has solved the problem. We'll let Medicare know. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Elise, it's my pleasure to join you. I wish you could all be here with me up in the San Juan Mountains in Telluride.
I'll tell you, I sure wish I could be. Peter Vell is the president and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association. You've heard me talk about all the research and legwork Sam and I are doing as we prepare to buy a new investment property. In fact, I'm going there a little bit later today after we're done taping to take some prospective tenants through it. Now, real estate investing is hard work, but once you become a landlord, there are some parts of the job that can be outsourced to a property management company under the right circumstances. I'm Elise Glink, and here's today's Real Estate Minute. Now, assuming you can find someone good, and by that I mean totally responsible and smart, there's only one major disadvantage to using a property management company that I can think of, and that's the cost. So Sam and I don't use a property manager for any of our properties just for that reason, but there are plenty of successful investors who do. And the average cost is roughly 10% of a month's rent, although you'll frequently have to pay the company a finder's fee of 1 month's rent each time the property turns over. Now, according to Zillow, there are five benefits to using a property management company. For starters, you may have fewer problem tenants. Good property managers will help you find problems with a tenant's application, hopefully, and they'll act as the go-between during the application process. The property management company may also be on call, although this probably comes with an extra fee for you, the investor, for any issues that arise with rental units. Broken toilet in the middle of the night? I know that's the one everybody always says. In all the years we've owned residential real estate, that one's never happened. But okay, broken toilet. You can rest easy knowing that someone else is going to get that call, although you'll still need to deal with any resolutions that require further investment in the property, like replacing the toilet. Zillow suggests that good property management companies may have a higher tenant retention rate because they know how to keep renters happy. It's their business, after all, or at least it should be if they're any good at it. And happy tenants usually go hand in hand with happy landlords. Another benefit is that property management companies know how to collect the rent on time. Collecting rent can be one of the more challenging parts of dealing with tenants. And since this is what these companies do all day long, they're usually skilled at resolving collection issues. In the end, using a property management company is about saving you stress. Time is money, and using a property management company will cost you some money in order to save you some time. You're the one who has to make the decision about whether that trade-off is worthwhile. And if you own enough properties, it probably will be. So let me say again that right now we don't use a property manager or a property management company. But when it comes to a commercial property, we might, because there are that many more tenants to deal with. And in the end, it all comes down to you anyway, the investor. No matter what you decide to do, before you hire someone, remember that you're only sharing some of the burden when you outsource the management of your rental property. You still need to do all the work to determine whether you're making a good investment when you buy, and owning a rental unit is always going to demand at least some amount of boots-on-the-ground oversight from the owner. Because while it's nice to have help in taking care of your property, nobody else is going to look after your investment with as much care and attention as you will. I know. Home. Nothing's as effective as a remodeling project. But you've got to be smart about it, or you're going to wind up creating a white elephant property that's priced too high for the neighborhood. I've got some clever ways you can boost your home's value without resorting to a major expense, like doing a major kitchen or bathroom remodel. And these ideas are especially important to consider if you're preparing to sell your house. I'm Elise Klink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. So for starters, try creating the appearance of more space by decluttering your home. A cluttered home can turn buyers off when they're flipping through hundreds of home photos online and picking out a dozen homes to see in a day. Without that foot traffic, a more prospective buyer milling about, your asking price is bound to slip. You should limit bulky furniture in smaller spaces, right? Less is more. Minimize decor, especially along any horizontal surfaces, so bookshelves, tops of pianos, so that the buyer's eyes are drawn to the house, not to your stuff. I mean, it's fine if you want them to make you an offer for your stuff, but usually that goes with you. It should also go without saying that you should make sure your home looks so clean and is completely organized. That means closets, too. Next, you should add curb appeal by tending to your garden and maybe even doing some touch-up work on the exterior of your home. That means doing a little landscaping. Again, the more appealing your home is at first glance and in the photographs you're going to be posting online, the more foot traffic, the more potential for offers, the better chance you're going to have of selling your house at or above asking price. Crazy? It's just that simple. And then you should touch up on all the little things. Fix the nicks in the wall, make sure the paint lines look clean and even, fix the sticky drawer. Any little fix that makes your home operate more smoothly is a wise investment of time and money. And if you've got a smelly pet, move that on as well. You really don't want to have smelly pets and odors when you're showing your house. You can also try repurposing a room. According to a survey by Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate, one in five millennials would prefer a home office be used when describing the dining room because that's how they'd actually use it. I guess eating and working is going to a new level here. This is not going to be true of all buyers, but it's such a good lesson in how turning away from traditional space designations can actually turn on a buyer to your house. Adding flex space, like an office that doubles as a guest room, that's a little bit more common, or even that dining room, is also highly desirable. You got to have a place to put the Airbnb people. And before you list your home, I want you to train your eye to become super practiced at staging. So just like decluttering your space can make it seem bigger, a few staging tricks can make it seem better cared for, nicer, and more modern. So for example, if you're preparing to paint the walls, keep them neutral, focus on adding changeable colors through accessories. Pick a focal point for each room, such as a nice painting or a coffee table with an intricately carved design. Build the decor around that. Designate a theme or common element, whether it's a color scheme, pattern, or design, and then thread that through the room. In fact, I have a bunch of videos online on this YouTube channel that you should check out that have really cool before and after staging examples so that you can see what it's like for a professional to come in and what the house looks like after she's done. By simply rethinking how your home looks and how you can use it, you can increase your home's value when you sell without spending the big bucks. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I particularly want to thank my guest, Peter Bell, President and CEO of the National Reverse Mortgage Lenders Association, for joining me today. Peter and I have known each other for, oh gosh, decades, decades and decades. I'm like 100 now. If there is anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinkglink.com. And if you're new to the show, be sure to subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please consider giving this show a rating and or a review in iTunes. You can do it by searching for the Elise Klink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and this helps the show get discovered by new people. I also want you to take a listen to Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Klink and John Byrne. You can find the first five or six episodes by Googling my name along with Monday Morning Marketing in quotes at iTunes. And again, be sure to give the show a rating or a review. It's for anybody who wants some extra marketing, PR, and social media advice. John's an award-winning former chief marketing officer for a global law firm and an attorney. And as you all know, I run a digital content agency, Think Glink Media. We help find solutions for all sorts of people, usually online, sometimes offline, but always smart and savvy. You can find us online at thinklinkmedia.com. Wow. That brings us to the end of another episode of The Elyse Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elyse Glink, and I'll be back next week with a new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.